A great American president, Abraham Lincoln, said that his country was the last best hope of Earth, a nation with a special mission to save mankind. I'm Professor Adam Smith, director of the Rothermere American Institute at Oxford, and on this podcast, I'll be exploring how this powerful idea shapes America.
In a final, have some of this, says Nicky P. Over extra for four more.
The latest and so far the most impressive effort to bring professional cricket to America launched in summer 2023. There are six franchises in Major League Cricket: the Los Angeles Knight Riders, the San Francisco Unicorns, the Seattle Orcas, the Texas Super Kings, the Washington Freedom, and the team that won last year's contest, MI New York. That's MI for Mumbai Indians, by the way, the other team owned in the same franchise. They defeated the Seattle Orcas in the final held at Grand Prairie Stadium on July the 30th last year. The stadium was packed and the atmosphere was like a religious revival.
On the money is Bolt. Cook wants to run, they're away.
Cricket is the world's second most popular sport after football, or soccer to the Americans, attracting a global audience of over 2.5 billion across 180 nations. In the world's biggest cricket powerhouse, by far, India, cricketers are demigods. Virat Kohli has 256 million Instagram followers. Yet cricket and America seem almost antithetical. Cricket, so it is often assumed, is both very English and to Americans very confusing. Yet cricket was once the most popular summer game in the United States. The first overseas England tour was to the United States in 1859. The professional players in that team earned the unheard-of sum of £90.
And that was a lot of money, right? That was no joke.
It's a lot of money in 1859. America then, just as now, was an El Dorado of sporting riches.
I think when the landscape architects lay down the plans for Central Park in sort of 1858, just a year before the game we're looking at here, they call the sports area the cricket pitch. And cricket's, you know, a big deal.
Yet just 10 years after that England tour, after 4 years of civil war and the rebirth of a newly consolidated United States, the new sport of baseball had all but erased cricket from the New York sporting press and largely from the American imagination. The prize money and the betting markets that were once drawn to the cricket field now turned to the baseball diamond. So what went wrong? How can we explain the strange death of American cricket? And what should we make of its present-day partial revival? Well, to answer these questions, I'm delighted to be joined by Ed Smith, former England cricketer, chief selector from 2018 to 2021, sometime BBC Test Match special commentator, and an award-winning journalist. He's the author, most relevantly perhaps to this discussion, of Playing Hardball, a wonderful book comparing cricket and baseball, and he's also the director of the Institute for Sports Humanities. And I'm also joined by an expert in American cricket history, Joseph Lynn, a curator at the C.C. Morris Cricket Library at Haverford College near Philadelphia, which holds the largest collection of cricket literature and memorabilia in the Western Hemisphere. We're going to get to the history in a moment, but I want to start, Ed, with the elephant in the room in any conversation about cricket in America, which is baseball. Now, Ed, you wrote 20 or so years ago now, you wrote a very funny book about your, I mean funny in a very good way, right? it's a very engaging, enjoyable book about you as a professional English cricketer falling in love with baseball and indeed having a go at playing it. And you say at the start of that book that cricket and baseball are like teenagers and their parents. They're very similar, yet unable to comprehend each other. So here's a starting question for you, Ed. I mean, do you think cricket and baseball, are they, should we think of them as branches of the same game, or are they fundamentally different beasts?
I think they are. They're branches of that central, you know, family tree of ball games. There's so much in common and yet so much that's different. And that's the beauty of the conversation, isn't it, between the two, that there's a disconnect, and yet they're almost identical. Same speed, pretty much, same distance, same reaction time, close attention to the aesthetic, to the mythological, to tradition, to the pastoral idyll, which is, of course, partly fraudulent because they've, you know, been very connected with cities too.
Both have an obsession with statistics, their own histories. They both also have a tradition of great commentating or broadcasting around it.
The spoken word and the written word. I don't wish to knock TV commentators in that. But I think, you know, the sound of summer and of the spoken word, particularly being so powerful, and legendary moments in each sport, and the audio associated with them is a big part of each tradition, I think.
Yeah, it absolutely is. As a obviously highly successful cricket player, how was it to play baseball? How different was it?
Well, you know, the truth is I never tried to kind of, you know, a different person from me, someone more talented, you know, a Joss Butler or a Freddie Flintoff, they probably could have had a go at changing codes if they'd tried young enough. For me, it was very much just to kind of get a taste of it. And in some ways, that aspect of the book, I wish I'd done differently. And I wish I'd been more immersed in trying to get good and push myself a bit harder rather than just suiting up in the New York Mets kit and having a hit and sort of getting a taste of it. There are huge differences. They've slightly converged, you know, T20 with its emphasis on power and rotation of the body, which creates, and this is, I'm now at the absolute limit of my understanding of physics, the torque, basically. Power comes from the movement of your arms in sync with, you know, your hips moving fast as well, which is what baseballers train for, the snap. Cricketers have got pretty good at, but that was, of course, very different. You know, I'm there in 99, 2000, 2001, and cricket was much more, we used to call a sideways game, much more physically restrained.
You're side onto the bowler and you're playing with a straight bat.
Playing with a straight bat. And real power was very rare. And of course, now it's sort of intrinsic to the game. So there's been a convergence of types, which I was lucky to be there as an observer. I saw two things early, if you like. 25 years ago. One was a sense of where data analytics was going, and that was handy for my life in cricket. And secondly, a sense of where true power comes from in terms of mechanics and your movement as a player, which, although I don't think it made much difference to me as a cricketer, it did help me as in terms of understanding where the game was going, which came in a little bit later as a selector and maybe someone who writes about it occasionally.
That's brilliant, because you've queued us up for an issue to talk about later, which is this idea of the potential convergence of the games in the 21st century. But Joe, let me bring you in here, because I want to go right back to the start here and talk about cricket in 19th century America. Paint a picture for us, if you don't mind, of as it were, the sporting scene more broadly in antebellum America in 1830s, 40s, 50s, United States? And can you sort of situate cricket playing within the broader sporting scene? What did it mean to play sport, to play bat and ball games or other kinds of sports at that time?
You know, in America at the time, bat and ball sports would have been very regional. Different cities, different areas of the country would play different versions of, you know, what would turn out to be later developing into baseball, whether it came from rounders or, you know, but cricket, we do know, was played here in the colonial times, and that perhaps George Washington played it at Valley Forge. It was a sport that was played by, you know, more of the gentleman type class in the United States prior to the Civil War, with some working class people playing as well, especially English immigrants that would have come here, that would have worked in early factories, that they too played it. You know, on the other hand, you would find far more casually other types of ball and bat sports played throughout the U.S. prior to the Civil War.
Joe, when you, if you spend time, as I've done in my life, for reading newspapers from the 1850s in New York, it's impossible to to read them for very long without coming across reports of cricket matches. And not just in the, there was a sporting press, there was a dedicated sporting press, but in the daily newspapers as well, they would publish long accounts of matches and scorecards, increasingly as the 1850s went on. And one thing you notice if you read those newspapers is the names of the big clubs stand out. So the biggest one, or perhaps the most famous one, was called the St. George's Club. And when you read reports of the St. George's Club, they would have roast beef and ale for lunch, and they would make this great performance, in other words, of their Englishness. So these were English immigrants playing for the St. George's Club, which was, as I understand it, the biggest and the wealthiest club in New York City at that time. Was that a pattern that held true more broadly? Was cricket, as it became more formalised in the 1850s, was cricket a game very much associated with fresh off the boat English immigrants?
The short answer is yes, that it was. But at the same time, in cities like Philadelphia, even prior to the Civil War, there was a movement to put Americans in charge of their own cricket club. St. George's in New York was referred to time and time again in American newspaper as a very Anglo-centric cricket club. And that, you know, as the 1850s go into the 1860s, et cetera, you'll find newspaper reports that will begin to point the finger and cast the blame at St. George's for remaining Anglo-centric. But in some other cities and towns, Boston's another one, you begin to see a movement towards Americans trying to control this sport inside their own cities, inside their own clubs.
It's actually quite a rare example of a way in which English ethnic or national identity was represented in the United States in the 19th century, because of course the advantage that English Protestant white immigrants had over other ethnic groups in the United States in the 1840s and 50s was that they could blend in, were entirely accepted by the mainstream Protestant culture. And so it's relatively rare, unlike with Irish or later with Italians or Germans, whatever, it's relatively rare to find institutions that are framed around Englishness. But cricket does appear to have been one, for all the fact that, as you say, it was also played by native-born Americans. Joe, you've got a photograph here from the C.C. Morris Cricket Library. Can you talk us through, what is it that we're looking at here? Can you describe it?
Sure. So this is a photograph from the 1860s, and what it shows is a New York 11 team that played a Philadelphia 11 team. There are four men sitting on the ground, and the four men that are sitting on the ground are the four professionals of the New York 11. The other members of the team are either seated or standing above them. They're the amateurs. The amateurs are dressed mostly in white. And the professionals seated on the ground.
And they're rather jaunty. I mean, listeners can probably imagine, this is obviously a Victorian era photograph in sepia that we're looking at here. And the professional, there's one on the left-hand side there who's sat with his leg crossed over and a little boater hat, looking very jaunty. The others are all looking very relaxed. The pros on the ground are looking like, you wouldn't want to run to them on a dark night necessarily, would you? I mean, they're looking like they mean business. They're not all wearing whites. It's actually quite striking, the difference, isn't it?
Right. So they're wearing like working man's clothes is, you know, how it would be described. While the other gentlemen are, you know, dressed like gentlemen. It was common for cricket clubs in the United States that could afford to. They would hire a professional cricketer from England to come over and take care of the ground, do coaching, and be probably a bowler, but be part of the team. These four professionals on the ground would be, you know, one from each of the major clubs in New York, including the St. George Club. And that would be, their professional was Harry Wright. And he's seated on the far right-hand side of this photograph on the ground.
It looks a bit like you've got several people, sort of Victorians, going for a picnic, and they've invited the gardeners in on the front row to sit down and take a sort of unified snap.
And so, Ed, this is a photograph taken in New York in the 1860s, but you would have seen, if you went back in the archives and looked at photographs of English cricket teams from the same period, would they have looked much the same? If you hadn't have known this was an American photograph, could you have told the difference?
Possibly, but I'm not sure why, actually. So that you know, it would have been an instinctive answer rather than a sort of intellectual one. One of the distinctive features of baseball is how quickly it's professionalized and becomes an industry standing on its own 2 feet.
Right.
And of course, that's distinct from county cricket, which for 100 years effectively divides people at the gate, divides them at the dressing room, forbids one category from being captain. And of course, you know,
yeah,
the same applies at England level too. So I think, you know, I think there's something about it that might make me think it was not English.
I mean, one thing that strikes me from looking at scorecards from this time period was that run totals were much lower. Generally, than is the case today. It's also true, by the way, from what I can see, that the numbers of runs scored in baseball games was much higher than is the case today. So the gap was much closer. I mean, I've got almost at random, I've got a scorecard in front of me from a New York game. This is 1861. And an English 11, this isn't a touring side. These are native-born Englishmen versus 22 American-born players in 1861. And the first innings totals are 38 and 56. Mm. And that doesn't seem out of line. So what does that tell us about what cricket was like in that period?
Yeah, it looks a bit like the scorecard that would derive from the dice game How's That?
Yes.
Which you probably played during. Or in fact, you know, me out of form in April, May on a bad pitch in the county season, desperately hoping that summer rolled round quickly so I could get a few runs on a flat pitch.
Hard batting, so that the bowlers are relatively stronger than the batters.
Or conditions favour the ball is probably the way to put it. I mean, so the biggest change in the development cricket is pitch curation, isn't it? That as you move to pitches that are harder and drier, and, you know, cut and rolled with all the technology that relies on, it gets easier to bat on. And in, you know, in the earlier days in cricket, of course, you know, it's extremely hard to hit the ball if the pitch is unreliable.
Lumpy pitches, balls springing up at you from all kinds of directions.
Hard enough as it is without changing direction. Yeah.
And Joe, one of the reasons why they wanted to win matches, perhaps, was because it was often a lot of money at stake. Well, there was a lot of betting around the game.
Right.
Sometimes
they're playing. And that would be a plague for early baseball as well, but there was an awful lot of betting that went on. You know, both cricket and baseball are going to have to deal with that in the 1800s and try to minimize the effect of gamblers being involved in the game. As Ed just mentioned, like, cricket will go amateur. Like, amateurs will gain control of this game and will keep that control up until past the mid 20th century. In baseball, they went the other direction and professionalized right off the bat, as you would say. And in that way, their feeling was they could control the betting because, you know, these men earned their livelihood from this game. They could try to do their best to clean up and keep the other element out from the players themselves.
I mean, certainly the impression you get from the press is that cricket in the late 1850s was big business in the United States. And perhaps the ultimate illustration of that is what's often described as the first overseas England tour, which was to the United States and also to Canada in 1859. And three international matches were played, England versus the United States. I don't think they have the status of first-class matches because they were an England 11 against an American 22. But, Joe, tell us about that series, why it happened, its impact.
That's going to be the ultimate question about the impact of that tour. But it put together by a team of, you know, 12 English professionals coming here after the season in England was done. So they came here in the fall. And by that time, as you know, they would learn that the weather kind of turns very cold in Canada and in New York. So some of the matches were played under, like, you know, difficult conditions.
Joe, you brought along another artifact from the C.C. Morris Cricket Library. So this is a scorecard we're looking at here, but it's a printed scorecard. So this is the kind of scorecard that you can still do this today, right? You would buy them at the game And it's printed with the score at the end of play on the previous day, right? So you can then, you can follow the game from then on. Is that right?
Correct. And, and you know, one of the Englishmen that put this tour together was Fred Lillywhite. And this, he brought his printing, his small printing press with him.
He brought his own printing press on the ship.
Correct. And then that traveled around with them. There are some people that turn around and say that one of the reasons why Fred Lillywhite was, you know, so excited about this tour to the United States was that he wanted to sell these printing presses as he moved around the country. But he certainly set up a tent and then printed the scores, you know, at the end of the day's play, like you said. At one point, it was difficult, though, traveling with this printing press.
I can imagine.
And it got lost, only to be recovered before they returned back to England. But
lost that, in inverted commas there. I assume someone else was involved in the losing, possibly. But
yeah, you're correct. And it's quite possible that the other players got tired of lugging this thing around.
What we're looking at here is a printed card, and it says at the top, correct score from Lillywhite's printing tent of Lords and Kennington Oval, London. And it appears to be, so this is not a scorecard from one of these three big international matches. Test matches, they weren't really test matches, but these big international matches between England and the United States. This is headed the north of England versus the south of England, with six gentlemen selected from the 22 at Philadelphia, Friday, October the 14th, 1859. So is this a sort of, so what is this, Joe? It's like an exhibition match, essentially, is it?
Right. So because, you know, all of the matches against either Canadian or American teams were so lopsided, even with, you know, playing at odds, right, with 22 players, these English professionals, you know, obviously were the best at what they did. And that was, so some of these matches ended early and they were so non-competitive that they tried to come up with other ways to keep the crowds around and, you know, round out, you know, the second and third or fourth day of play that had been scheduled. So they did, they began to mix the teams together. And so half of the Englishmen would go to one team, the other half to the other, and then divide up the best of the American or Canadian players and try to see whether that would be a much more competitive match. And it was a chance for those American and Canadian players now to really learn from these English professionals as to how this sport should really be played.
And we should say that this reinforces this point about these being low scoring matches in those days, because the first innings, which is the south of England, which is the only part of the game that's been completed at this point, they were all out for 59, with the top scorers scoring 10 apiece. And the two top scorers are Caffin and a man called Wisden. Is that the Wisden of Wisden fame?
That is the Wisden.
For American listeners, and we do have a lot of American listeners, Ed, perhaps you can come in and tell American listeners why I'm dwelling on the name Wisden.
Well, you know, Wisden, the Wisden Almanac, yeah, records the crucial matches, essays, facts, perspectives.
It's an iconic little yellow brick book.
Many great cricket fans collect each Wisden Almanac.
Yeah.
And I think to get a complete set, including the rare war years editions, would probably be a significant acquisition at an auction house.
It would. So there's real sort of cricketing history just in this scorecard. But look, we're dwelling on, at the moment, we're talking about 1859 and the prevalence of cricket in antebellum America. But this is the high point, because now we hit the Civil War. I was reading an article by an American cricketer from the American Cricketing Magazine in the early 20th century. And this is what he said, recalling these golden years before the Civil War. We had a large number of good young men playing the game up to that time, and then the war fever took hold of them. When hostility between North and South broke out, away went our players to the front, and the cricket field was deserted. Those that returned from the war never took up the game again. So cricket, the forgotten casualty of the American Civil War, Joe?
Yes. Though it wasn't, you know, it wasn't quite dead, but it certainly got wounded.
And why was that? Why did the war deal a near fatal blow to American cricket?
Part of the reason was that baseball was now played inside the Union Army camps of the North. And it was the soldiers coming from New York City that turned around and said, you know, well, here's how we play the sport in New York versus the way it's played in, you know, Massachusetts or Ohio, wherever else these other soldiers were coming from. And they were able to, you know, explain the rules, and, you know, you didn't have to prepare the ground. You could just put down a couple of bases and a pitcher's mound, grab a bat, and, you know, form your teams and off you go. And so it seemed to be an easy pickup kind of a game to play. And likewise, it was over in a couple of hours, the whole match. It didn't have to be played day after day. So what happened is, of course, that these men then go back to their home states when the war is over, and they're able to show others this, you know, new sport with the New York rules. So really the Civil War helped to standardize, you know, the set of rules for baseball. And yes, as it turns out, would be very difficult for cricket now to keep its level of popularity going. Now it was in full competition with baseball.
Ed, as a cricket player, can you, it seems to me that I can imagine, as Joe's saying there, that there were some very practical reasons why baseball might have overtaken cricket in army camps, because mm-hmm. as he says, you don't, the ball doesn't need to, well, this is where we get into the confusion of terms. The ball doesn't need to pitch. It doesn't need to bounce on the ground in baseball. And so you don't need to prepare the wicket mm-hmm. in the same way that you do in cricket. Do you reckon, Ed, that it may also be the case that baseball is an easier sport because you participate more often? There's less waiting around, bluntly, in baseball as a player?
Maybe, and then that becomes part of the narrative after the war, doesn't it? I think that clearly there's an element that baseball is a step in the direction of football, what we would call football, dare I say soccer for American listeners, you know, and get attacked by English guys for using that term. But so basically, when enviously us cricket folk watch a football match starting up, four jumpers will do, right? That creates the goals and then off you go. In the same way, sort of setting up a baseball diamond is easier. It doesn't rely on such good pitch curation. So sort of off you go. There's an element that, and the straitened circumstances with less time, less money, less leisure, yes, baseball becomes, you know, easier to arrange. And then I think that also trips over into a question of national identity and defining what it is to be American against sort of being English. And that's a key part of the sales pitch. Once the American sporting industry gets its hands on a game of our own, then of course you're looking for the other. And cricket gets on the wrong side of that identity struggle. Baseball becomes associated with being truly American. Cricket is seen as, is positioned as effete and English and of the past, and, you know, not fully ours or not ours at all.
For me, as a historian of the American Civil War era, I mean, the metaphor here is just, the analogy is just sort of overwhelmingly obvious, that the United States is about, the American Civil War consolidates the United States in all kinds of ways. It shifts the meaning of American national identity. It creates the foundations for the modern industrialized, modern United States. And baseball serves the purpose of that new America in a way that it would have been very difficult for cricket to do. I think you've put it extremely well there.
If I could just for a second go back to the original photograph we were discussing, and I mentioned that name Harry Wright, the English, you know, cricket professional for, you know, the St. George Club. Harry Wright, in 1865, as the Civil War came to an end, was lured away to the city of Cincinnati in Ohio to become a cricket professional for a cricket team there. The Cincinnati Cricket Club shares its ground with the local, you know, baseball club. And so he tries out for the baseball team. And as it turns out, you know, he's a very good cricketer. He's a very good baseball player. He played in one of those 1859 matches against the English professionals. But Harry Wright is definitely given credit for starting the first professional, openly professional baseball team, the Cincinnati Red Stockings, which he managed and played for. And they went on a barnstorming, you know, tour across the United States in 1869. They did not lose a single match. They played, you know, close to 60 matches against, you know, local teams. Some of those matches were very, very competitive. Yet at the end of the day, the Red Stockings, you know, won all of their matches. And that more than anything else, I really do believe proved that people will come and they will pay to see the best players playing a sport on the highest level that it can be played on. So as much as baseball will come up with the Abner Doubleday myth, you know, of it's good, its own creation story, you cannot escape that without cricket and cricket being played in the United States, baseball as we know it would probably not have developed at the time and in the manner in which it developed without that legacy of cricket, which baseball will do its kind of its best to kind of minimize, even though Harry Wright will make it into the Baseball Hall of Fame, which is the highest honor that can be bestowed, and his younger brother George as well.
So Harry Wright sort of personifies this shift from cricket to baseball and professional baseball,
right,
in really deep ways, kind of emerging out of the pre-Civil War experience of cricket playing. Joe, you mentioned there the Abner Doubleday myth. So let's just double down on the Doubleday myth. So there's this huge effort goes on to the level of literally congressional hearings in order to establish the principle that baseball is a solely and exclusively American sport, and despite what you've just told us, has absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with cricket or
rounders,
children's game of rounders, right, or anything else. So,
right.
So tell us about, who was this Abner Doubleday? I mean, I know who he was because he fought in the Civil War.
He did. Abner Doubleday was at Fort Sumter when the Civil War began. He was Major Anderson's right second in command.
Yeah.
And he also played a very pivotal role, as you know, on the first day of the Battle of Gettysburg, but then was relieved of command as other, you know, higher ranking generals showed up and is, you know, then kind of fades away. But he certainly was, you know, a Civil War hero. And it really, this all comes down to, you know, Albert Spaulding is really the man. And he's a combination of the Lily White and the Wisden kind of combined for America. And, you know, Spaulding played a little bit of cricket, but certainly was very, you know, was very good at baseball. Was a great baseball pitcher there in the 1800s. He's the one that's going to drive this to establish that baseball has an American origin story, that it is not derived from any kind of foreign sport whatsoever. And he's the one that will press for a commission to be set up to get to the bottom of where baseball really came from. As it turns out, Abner Doubleday was a member of the Theosophical Society, which was, you know, a syncretic religious movement trying to unite all world religions together. And Abner Doubleday was the head of the American branch of that. And another member of the same society was Spaulding. So Abner Doubleday passes away, and this commission is set up to find who was it and where was baseball created. And Spaulding kind of pushes the story that it was his good friend, Abner Doubleday.
At Cooperstown in 1839, and he never went there. Is that correct? He never went to Cooperstown?
Well, he was from that region of New York, but in 1839, he would have been at West Point.
West Point.
The America's Military Academy. And a lot of it went to, it turns out, a man named Abner Groves, who was interviewed by that commission, and he said he was present there in 1839 when Doubleday laid out the diamond there in Cooperstown, New York. And as it turns out, Groves was 5 years old when that occurred. And all these many decades later, he remembered that story.
Makings of a good politician.
Absolutely.
Remembering someone played a game they weren't at. Yeah.
Do you know, it's upstate New York. And I mean, I mentioned the Mormons earlier on in the context of cricket. I have to say that I'm hearing echoes of Mormon people are probably upset if I say this, but it's a very similar kind of invention story, isn't it?
That's
something very specific.
Yes.
To New York. And in fact, it's the same time period, same emerging out of the same kind of religious culture in upstate New York. It's quite an uncanny similarity, actually. Ed, I can see that you're fingering what looks to be a baseball there.
Yeah, no, that's right. I just found it on my bookcase. Actually, I do remember, it would have been 24 years ago, driving up to Cooperstown from when I was riding playing hardball and driving up from New York and knowing enough to know it was a complete myth. And yet the museum there, the Hall of Fame, is quite coy about it all. It's sort of like no one really knows. It's all a bit hard to say. It's both incredibly portentous. So instead of saying sport or ball game, it would say games of ball, you know, had been played in many different ways. So it's all very arch and ex cathedra. And then suddenly very coy, like, we're not too sure, like, really what happened. Well, we're sure what didn't happen was that the guy who wasn't there didn't invent it. So it's a funny thing. And you sense even now that, you know, that baseball slightly guards its origin myth. But it's very interesting, isn't it, that you need something to kick against. You know, Adam, as a historian, you know, identity, you know, whether that's Britain and France or America and Britain or whatever it might be, there's that sense of defining who you are by what you're not.
Yeah.
And that's very deeply embedded in baseball. And, you know, you would know much better than me, a significant part of the American story and America's greatness too.
I agree. You know, I think one way to frame American history is America is a country that constantly searches for a national identity. And it's almost as if every generation has to come along and define that national identity. And it turns out there in the last half of the 1800s, baseball stepped right into that as a way to further nuance what that national identity at the time, you know, might be.
Meanwhile, cricket doesn't disappear entirely. It continues to be played, especially around Philadelphia, where you are now, Joe. And there are some in the Edwardian period. There's at least one very prominent and successful American player,
right?
Bart King, who plays, I think, does he play some seasons in England?
Yes, because the Philadelphia cricket scene in the late 1800s becomes dominated by four major cricket clubs that were very, very socially exclusive. Those four cricket clubs in Philadelphia, all controlled by Americans, with American players, fiercely competed against one another year in and year out. And, you know, the gentlemen of Philadelphia is what they call themselves. The best players from these teams toured and played against amateur sides. Then starting in 1897 and 1903 and 1908, the gentlemen of Philadelphia went to England and now began to play county cricket teams. And Bart King was seen as being the best of the lot. By the time he got to the 1908 season, he headed the bowling averages for England with, conceding only 11 runs per wicket.
Ed, what I'm struck by listening to Jay there is that there's an alternative historical trajectory, path not taken here. In the United States, you have cricket played by an elite around Philadelphia, a social elite. In the meantime, in the 1890s, there is efforts made to introduce baseball in England, and it's a working class sport. In fact, he's organized around professional football clubs, isn't it? Derby County,
Aston Villa. There were four. Got two.
Nottingham Forest. I want to say Nottingham Forest. Anyway, I'm just intrigued by this sort of alternative possibility that the baseball might have become, as it were, the working class summer game in both England and the United States. Well, cricket retreated to the echelons of public schools and amateurs. Mm-hmm. And obviously that didn't happen on either side. And somehow or other, despite, or perhaps maybe because of the gentleman players distinction, cricket in England, and perhaps especially in Lancashire and Yorkshire, retained a working class dimension, so that, you know, lads would be playing cricket in the back streets as well as on the playing fields of Eton, and somehow or other it kind of held together as a national game in a way that was obviously not true in the United States.
Yeah, interesting. So in other words, look, to start with, let's talk about cricket and its relationship in England with class. To some degree, the sense of division is quite arbitrary and superficial, though strong, because for most of its history in England, cricket's been played by all sectors of society, even though it's a very, you know, moot point today in the current trajectory and questions of access and the expense of the game are very real issues today. And the fact, as you sort of allude to, that, you know, the ability to play on really good pitches, often at very good schools, is causing a social skew, or has caused a social skew. But take all taken together, cricket has attracted people from all backgrounds consistently, probably to a greater degree than rugby or football, rugby union, I should specify, you know, which obviously suffers its split. And then football, which probably is now becoming the game for everyone more than it used to be, because it's just become such a ubiquitous sport that all schools play it in a way that when I was a kid, that wasn't the case. You know, some schools played rugby and not football, and other people just didn't have anything to do with rugby union. So I think for a lot of English education, we forget how well cricket has unified different parts of society, and long may that continue, although it's, of course, you know, a big debate today. Counterfactuals are always interesting to historians, and there are two. They run in both directions. What if baseball had properly taken roots in England, and what if cricket had survived and continued to flourish in America? Yeah, it's very hard to say. I would say that I'm very suspicious of the idea that sports are naturally and intrinsically suited to peoples. I don't see that, really. I don't think that there's something un-American about cricket. I don't think there's anything un-English about baseball. I think it's just the way it panned out, which probably leads us to where we might get to now. At the Institute I founded, the Institute of Sports Humanities, there was a very good lecture a couple of weeks ago at Lord's, and Professor Tony Collins, who's a great historian of sport and globalization, gave a very interesting lecture. And at the end of it, there was a discussion about how cricket might, if it ever does, achieve a bit more balance in terms of India and the rest of the world. And one of the things that emerged in the conversation is, from an economic perspective, that's extremely unlikely, unless there is a cricket playing country which has something like the demographics and economic muscle of India. Because as long as there are 1.2 billion Indians, a lot of them love cricket and they're buying stuff to do with cricket, like, for example, subscriptions to watch the IPL on television, and the rest of the world added up together that plays cricket isn't as great as that in economic or demographic terms, then really, ultimately, India will end up as, if you like, running the game completely, even more than it does at the moment. May not be a bad thing. It doesn't have to be something that to be actively resisted, but it's just a statement of likelihood. But if cricket becomes a serious feature of life in America, or, you know, again, may not seem very likely, but or China, then you can imagine a greater equipoise at global level. So I think cricket should take a very, I say cricket, you know, cricket as it has been, you know, if you like, the legacy cricket countries should pay very close attention to cricket in America. You know, there's enough of an entrepreneur in me, despite being the son of a novelist and an art teacher and no entrepreneurial background whatsoever, but there's enough of an entrepreneur in me to think that it's an incredible opportunity. And we're just beginning, you know, through Major League Cricket to see what might happen. You know, if I, you know, I'd be looking to host as many global tournaments in America as possible.
I think the T20 World Cup is going to be jointly hosted with West Indies and the United States, isn't it? So it does appear that the cricketing world is paying more attention. This Major League Cricket, which launched last year with six professional sides, franchises, I guess you call them. I mean, how successful was it? My assumption is that it's the immigrant populations from cricket playing countries that are the base for Major League Cricket in the US.
You are 100% correct about that. And I think, you know, so if people frame the story that, you know, cricket died in the United States either after the Civil War, World War One, or however you want to put it, I believe that Major League Cricket and the ICC are really kind of hoping that really was just a period of hibernation.
Are we, in a way, coming full circle in another sense? Because, of course, the kind of cricket we're talking about here being played in the US in Major League Cricket is T20 cricket. So I mean, for American listeners who don't know, that's the sort of newest and shortest and fastest and most energetic and most razzmatazz and, dare I say it in this context, most American form.
I was going to say the most baseball-like version.
Well, that's where I'm going with this. Right, so has cricket become more like baseball? And is that, and on some level, deliberate? Or is that part of its potential global success, and especially its success in the United States?
I firmly believe that the ICC and other cricket authorities are betting that that is exactly what the appeal would be, that this is now the version that Americans, you know, would actually sit up and pay attention to, because it is a much shortened, you know, form of the game, that a 2020 match, a T20 match lasts about, you know, the length of a baseball game. But at the same time, to be honest with you, baseball has also had the same problems that cricket has had. You know, that they've tried now to speed up a baseball game. They have a pitch count now where pitchers have to deliver a ball, you know, within 20 seconds. And they're doing all kinds of things to increase the scoring as well as shorten the length of the game. It's funny that both sports, cricket and baseball, have gone through this period now where attendance went down a little bit, you know, and crowds were not as enthusiastic. It's almost like in the post-industrial world, perhaps cricket and baseball needed to adjust. It's funny when you read the early things that, you know, baseball was so much popular in America because it was a much faster game than cricket. And, you know, it was filled with snappy razzmatazz type of sport. And, you know, now when you ask Americans, you know, which sport will they want to tune into, they'll say football, American football, because baseball's too slow.
There's also a point, isn't there, I think, about when nostalgia and maybe small C conservatism is in your DNA and also maybe in some of your appeal. You've got to be careful you don't start believing your own hype. And, you know, I love Test cricket.
Me too.
I love the cadence of the long game and its subtlety and skill. However, as a worldview, saying the vulgarians are taking over, I can't believe it, you're all idiots, that's not a great way to view the world. And you won't win that way. And I get annoyed when I think cricket takes that stance, you know. And the culture wars in cricket have happened. You know, there are times when I was selected for England cricket, there were times when I couldn't believe how absurd the determination was to see evidence of, you know, an immoral decline and fall everywhere. No, we're just trying to win, actually. So the idea that every decision should be viewed through the lens of they don't care about Test cricket, it was just ridiculous. But it's become stronger and stronger. And it's because I think there's a sense of threat around that part of the game, which I understand, but you've got to be careful that you don't view all change and all evolution as wrong intrinsically. And I think sometimes both cricket and baseball can suffer from that.
I do firmly believe, too, you know, paraphrase George Bernard Shaw, that cricket and baseball are two sports separated by a common language. And it's not just a sport. It's not just men playing, you know, a game they learned how to play as children. It becomes a matter of national identity. It becomes a matter of culture. And I think you find that both with cricket and with baseball writers, those two sports lend themselves, I think, to that kind of identification for nationality. And it becomes that important.
Yeah. What does he know of cricket who only cricket knows? And the famous C.L.R. James quote that to write the story of one is to write the story of everything. Ed and Joe, thank you both very much indeed. This has been great fun.
Thank you.
I was talking to former England cricketer and baseball enthusiast Ed Smith, the director of the Institute for Sports Humanities, and to Joe Lynn of the C.C. Morris Cricket Museum in Haverford, Pennsylvania. On this podcast, The Last Best Hope, we explore the powerful idea of American exceptionalism, and there are few more obvious markers of the ways in which the U.S. has gone its own way than in the world of sport. Yet, as in other aspects of politics and culture, nation building requires the exaggeration of national distinctiveness. In a lower run scoring age, before the Civil War remade the United States, cricket had its day in the American sun. Maybe in a new age of T20 razzmatazz, cricket will build a market in America again. If so, cricket will surely change, but so too will America. You've been listening to The Last Best Hope, a podcast from the RAI at Oxford University. If you've enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and leave a review wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're able, we'd be very grateful indeed if you could make a donation to allow us to continue making these programmes. To do so, go to www.rai.ox.ac.uk. That's rai.ox.ac.uk. Our producer is Emily Williams, and I'm Adam Smith. Goodbye.